Mr. Druther has given us
this is an object, somebody.
To pick up a point which ought not be missed. And that is that almost every system that is developed, of the type that she was describing this morning, whether it's the hippies or the black Zionists or the black student school or anything, almost anything else, including the Lutheran Church, to a large extent, have seen the problems of living in society in terms of an alternative. It is either the world or non-world. It's either the establishment or not the establishment. It's either law or grace. Capitalize it if you like. This is in terms of a disjunctive where most persons who have tried to do what is going on either live in the city or they move outside and establish their community. Now the trick, obviously, is to coordinate these things by saying it's law and grace. It's establishment and beyond establishment. You may not have recognized it, but this, of course, is what I've been trying to talk about. Our culture has usually thought of the person as being called out of the sinful world into kind of a redeemed status and holding himself pure and aloof. And this, of course, is heretical from the ground up. Monday evening, rather inarticulately, not my fault, the audiences, as all semanticists know, there's nothing unclear about the message. Most of the mistakes are made by the hearer, suffering from their own preconceptions rather than mine. I was trying to say that the job of the body of Christ that's us is to minister to, obviously, the non-body, those persons who are not yet part of the functioning organization. And this happens, as we saw in the passages from Philippians that we were looking at in that context, in the sense that, first of all, you build the body of Christ itself with its various members, the ears and the eyes, the doctors and the preachers, and the other persons. Building up its own strength by serving itself, but not for the purpose of serving itself, but rather ultimately for the purpose of serving the world in which it's found. And this is the ministerial act. We make a serious mistake if we think that we have organized a church solely and exclusively for our comfort and convenience. This is not the name of the game. The name of the game is in order that we may become the organic structure, the physical representation, the body of Christ, through which the ministry of God flows to the world. Now that ministration occurs not just through the flesh, not just through one type of created organism, as verbal statements, proclamation, for example, but it occurs through every type of created thing over which God has given man control, the right to dominate, to use, and to act. Every tool that's been created over which man has been placed in dominion. And as Rosemary said a little while ago, the systems, the establishment, the concept of law, one of the things that's been created. And law is as a system. Remember, yesterday morning I was trying to convince you that law is a system, it's a technique, it's a way of resolving problems which destroy mankind. That is, problems which alienate, problems which make people pull out of the city and build in the country, or problems which take people out of the establishment and make them non-establishment, or problems which make a church body say, we adhere to law, salvation by works, while we over here adhere to grace and by grace alone. And what results is an alienation. And that alienation, as I explained very, very carefully yesterday, and if you didn't understand, it's only because you're stupid, is what is known as sin. sin is alienation, and again, as Mrs. Ruther pointed out very well this morning, if you were listening to her, this alienation is the problem that we've got to worry about. And it is described in terms of being, not doing. It is what you are. It's your lifestyle, as Dr. Christensen has called it here. And conversion, which we speak about in Christianity, is to take that being and make it that being. However, the person has become reconciled by what is called conversion. For heaven's sake, don't let me turn you off by that word conversion. I know that you've grown up thinking that that's kind of an emotional response. And that's not what the word conversion means. It means to take something and transform it over to something else. Think of the power line out there, if you will, where you transform direct current into alternating current in order that it can be useful. So you transform a person from an alienated, useless guy sitting out in the country going through emotional experiences as a result of too much pot, and transform him into a functioning unit able to take the tools which have been given to him and to do useful things with them. That is, to minister, to serve. We worship correctly when we serve. Our service is worship. Our worship is service. The service does not start at 10 o'clock and end at 11. That's not what it means on the service hymnal. And when you sing the prayer over there, "May strength and for your service be," does not mean "give me the strength to get through it once more." The little kid who heard that somebody had died in the service, only response was, you know, which one, 8:30 or 11? This is not the notion that we're working on. The notion that you've got to get here is that you actually are mobilized. See, that you're free, that you are enabled to serve, and you serve with tools. Like wheelbarrows, or bulldozers, or textbooks, or scalpels, or telescopes, or pharmaceuticals. And these things are necessary in order to implement the desire to serve, to minister. And we make a terrible mistake when we absolutize, make an idol of, bow down, and worship wheelbarrows. Wheelbarrows are simply not entitled to that kind of respect. You must remember that wheelbarrows can be modified. You can make a better wheelbarrow. A wheelbarrow is a tremendously useful thing. Without it, the Irish probably would not have learned to stand erect yet. But one must not think that a wheelbarrow is in any point reached its final evolutionary stage of utility. The iron wheel gave way to the rubber tire, and there are lots of other improvements still to be made. Law is a tool. It must not be absolutized. Neither in its rules, nor in its process. And these are the two cardinal elements of law that we were talking about yesterday morning. That is, the rule, which is stated by somebody someplace. Thou shalt not drive more than 35 miles an hour. If you want to make that like the law of the Medes and Persians, never being altered and never being changed, you're going to have a terribly stagnant society after a while, and tremendous amounts of evasion, and it's almost the kind of stupidity that one would see if a man who had power to speak should say, for example, that thou shalt not practice birth control. You're going to wind up with wide-scale evasion because it's an attempt to state a rule which is no longer utility. And when a rule is not useful to the society in which it's being used, and you go around saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, we simply have to preserve the wheelbarrow in its pristine glory, or else we've gone to pot," you've got a pretty serious thing. I tried to illustrate this yesterday morning for you by saying that the reason that we are driven to this attempt to idolize rules, the law, is that because the law has a very limited means of enforcement. Talk about that a little bit more this morning. And in order to try and get more mileage out of the implementation, or to make it, we think, a little bit more useful, we tend toward identifying in a sacral nature. Moses with the tablets, direct from headquarters. This is not Moses speaking. United States Supreme Court, in the case of Griswold against Connecticut, which Mrs. Ruther described last night. I don't know whether she was aware of it or not. And a excellent natural law man by the name of Justice William Douglas. The rest of the court pointing at him saying, Douglas, you're just a natural lawyer at heart, because Douglas was saying, there is a fundamental, inalienable right to have intercourse with one's wife in a way that suits them and is effective for them, with which man may not tamper. It is one of the reserved rights which identifies a human being. And Justice Douglas at this point, who, as you will see before we are through this morning, is a most unlikely candidate to be called a natural lawyer, at this point became a natural lawyer, became an advocate of natural law. One must back up and look sort of calmly at this problem in order to escape madness. So you ask yourself again, still reviewing here briefly, what's the occasion for making pronouncements or a law? The occasion is always conflict, always conflict. The only time that you get a rule pronouncement or an exercise of law is when two things have come into a position where the buyer says to the seller, you cheated me, and the seller says, I didn't. They're here, and there is impending violence of a type that is going to disrupt the harmony of the human relationship. It's going to cause another alienation. It's going to put people out of contact, which is exactly what we want to try and avoid. And so we try by this mechanism to minimize that contact, that disruption, that rift. In the process of doing so, law strives for justice. Justice is a synonym for poverty. It means you take what you've got coming, and I'll take what I've got coming. I don't get any of yours, and you don't get any of mine. Yours is yours, mine is mine. That's fair and square. That's just. But when you strive for justice, you are striving for something which is minimal in our society. You're capable of doing much better than this. I hope that the time never comes that my wife and I treat each other justly. Be at least just. That's a platform from which we launch. But we do a lot better than justice. Think. Yesterday, I tried to describe this for you by saying that the function of law, essentially, is to identify those areas within which a person is free to innovate and act. I am protected in my experimentation. I am expected in my own thing. I am expected in trying to maximize the values that I see in life. And law's job is to keep you off my back while I'm trying to work this out. Law, in this sense, is not a helping discipline. It rather is a protecting or a limiting one. Well, because law does arise in the context of conflict, you begin to see something which is extremely significant, which you must recognize, and that is that the only kind of question that's ever going to be a legal question is one which cannot be given a sensible answer. If a man is supposed to deliver a ton of coal to a buyer for $25 and he dumps something in the buyer's backyard, and the buyer says that's not coal, there's a way of determining whether or not it's coal. You get in a half a dozen scientists, and they can go through whatever process they go through, and they announce that this is coal. Or it's not coal. And most of us will take their word because there are scientific tests for determining what is coal and what isn't. So we may have a grading problem. Whether it's good coal, bad coal, you know, better or worse coal, whether it's larger lumps, smaller lumps. And that's why we set out grades and standards. We make rules about that. So we know that nut coal comes in this size, lump coal comes in that size, and hard coal is this kind, and bituminous coal is that kind. We can do these things in grades and standards, and then we can find out. You don't have to sue each other about that. You can do it scientifically. Or if you say it's not a ton, that's fairly simple. You can throw it on a scale and weigh it. And most of us will agree that the scale can be tested out, and we've got agreed amounts of tonnage here, or pounds and ounces. And we can weigh it. You don't have to sue each other about that. Once in a while, you get into an argument which cannot be resolved quite so simply, and so you take it to the experts. Now, that may be an expert guy in geology. It may be Larry can help you out in this, or it may be that you get to one pretty soon where the experts are in disagreement. So then you take it ultimately to a lawyer. And the lawyer will now tell you, this is the way that we resolve these kinds of disputes. And you resolve disputes by starting out with certain presumptions. It is assumed that the plaintiff normally has the burden of being persuasive. If I'm going in and praying for relief, when you ask your client, what is your prayer? If he doesn't say, Our Father who art and so forth, he may tell you, my prayer is that I've been gypped by the guy who sold coal to me, and I want relief from that. And you say, all right, then you have the burden of being persuasive. You have the burden of proof. You must overcome the presumption that that the court ought not to interfere. Courts normally do not interfere in private squabbles. They try and retain the individual of action as much as possible. If you get into it, then the guy who is the plaintiff must overcome that burden. Well, that burden of proof, the burden of being persuasive, is going to vary. I know that when people draw the scales of justice, they always draw a nice balance like that. But that's not the way it sits when it's idle. It sits there waiting for a case and it's really tilted a little bit like this. The defendant is over here and the plaintiff is over here. The plaintiff's got to come in and he's got to prove his case. He's got to overcome that initial burden of carrying the proof. In a civil case, this is just by a preponderance of evidence. You just barely have to get it over there. Just be more believable than the other guy. There are some things that have bigger presumptions of proof. For example, in a criminal case, the man is presumed innocent until he's proven guilty, and the presumption of innocence is a very strong one. You got to go in what the books call, I mean the popular books and the television, beyond a reasonable shadow of doubt, whatever in the Dickens that means. What it means is that the scale is tilted way over here in favor of the man who is accused of a crime, and you really got to kick it with very persuasive evidence before you get it over there. Then there are some things that, like the presumption of legitimacy of a child who is born to a married woman, which is very strong indeed. A tremendous presumption in favor of legitimacy. In fact, in some cultures, they have taken it over here and tied it down to the ground and said, you can't disprove it. You get some pretty violent manifestations of this. For example, in Washington, if a woman gives birth to a child any time up to about 10 months, after she's last had intercourse with her husband. That's presumed to be a legitimate child. The gestation period for children in the state of Washington born to humans is almost equal to that of elephants. For the very simple reason, we don't want to be persuaded to the contrary. Very deliberate. All right, so you get to that kind of initial idea that there has to be a carrying out of the burden. In this process, you are identifying what has to happen so that a lawyer can say to you when you come in doing the consultation, well, if you take this case to trial, it is probable that the court will give this decision. And again, as we saw yesterday, law, in order to function in our society, must do two things. One, it must give us a basis for predicting future decisions, how a matter will be decided when it's taken to a court, in order that you can plan, so that you can write your contracts and trusts and deeds and so forth. And therefore, it must be stable and unchanging. But it must also do justice in the individual case, adapt itself to meet changing circumstances, and therefore must be constantly in a process of growth and development and change. And so, as we saw then, all that law has to do to be successful is to remain stable and fixed while it changes rapidly. This makes for a very interesting process, and it is absolutely necessary that both of these functions occur. At a moderated, modulated process in a way that's tolerable to the society in which we live. So you go through the rest of those jobs that we put on the board yesterday, identifying trouble spots, trying to avoid them in advance, making changes in our social machinery, identifying authority in a way that it's tolerable to the people so that you don't have hippie movements and black Zionists and so forth popping up, and you don't have splinter groups leaving the church, you don't have schisms occurring, you don't have a confrontation which puts the Pope in a position where he looks like an idiot and risks the fabric of the organization. You don't have a Lutheran church which is so badly hung up on the notion of whether or not we are going to enter into social ministry or not that we are threatening our own survival by a schism. You avoid these sorts of terrible confrontations by modulating. through legal processes, the best of which is, of course, the involvement in the making of the rule itself. If you are caught up in the dynamic of your society, which is moving more rapidly than you can, you must resort to the fiat of law, and if that doesn't work, God save the Queen, we're through. Somebody pulled the plunk of the stopper, and we go down the drain. Now, if the lawyer does not have enough basis from earlier decisions or statutes or whatever he's looking at by way of his authority to be able to predict with enough assurance so he's willing to say to the client, this is the way it's going to come out, and it's pretty clear, it's 80 to 20, it's going to come out this way. Therefore, I advise you to settle quickly because you're a loser. If the lawyer can't do that for his client, it may come to the place where there's a trial. In a trial, you go through the process, you ask the judge finally, we'll talk about this in a moment, the judge goes through a trial process, and then he comes to a decision. That decision may be appealed. You go through an appeal, you argue the thing all over again. When you get all through with that argument, notice what you've done. Out of, let's say, 1,000 automobiles that bump into each other, 1,000 instances in which automobiles bump into each other, maybe 5 of those will not be settled by the insurance company or the parties who are involved. Maybe 5 will get into the hands of a lawyer. Maybe 1. Well, let's make it 4, and that's why I won't run out of it. Maybe 2, and that's a gross exaggeration, statistically. We'll get into trial and actually reach a decision. A great, great bulk of all the stuff that goes into a pleading, a complaint, will be settled, as we say, on the courthouse steps and never be tried at all, reach a compromise. A little bit will come through the trial court, and you'll actually get a court deciding it. And then out of that, some fractional percentage will go to the Supreme Court of your state for a decision. And that decision will be very often written by a good, solid court that decides it by a 5-4 decision. The kind that I was discussing with you the other evening. This is the first place where you write a decision, then the court announces what the law is, and then we all know. Now, what we have done in this process is to take the great, great bulk of disputes, and we've come up here on the top, and we've flicked off an infinitesimal part that we cannot resolve by any other rational process. You can't weigh it, you can't measure it, you can't wrap litmus paper around it, you cannot get people to agree, and so you go through this process of trying to do it in a way that commends itself to the populace so that they're willing to accept the decision. That's what it means to assign authority in a way that's tolerable, that people will accept it, that people are willing to walk out of there saying, I still think I was right. However, I had a fair trial, I was heard, and I'm willing to abide by the decision that's reached. When the sense of injustice mounts to the place where the guy walks out and says, I won't accept it, then you've got a movement, and you've got a splinter, you've got a schism, you've got black nationalists. You've got whatever it is that happens to be bugging your establishment at the moment. So you go through this process of trying to do this. Having done so, you realize, if you watch it, that you've gotten yourself into a place where there just is no answer. There just isn't a decision. If there were a decision for those problems, it would have been reached by men of good spirit, acting honestly through their test tubes or microscopes or textbooks or in some other way, and they would have arrived at that answer long since. Therefore, no lawyer ever will tell you that he's got an answer if he's being careful. He will tell you that he will give you an opinion, a judgment, a decision, but in terms of absolutizing, this is the way it is and it can't be any other way, never. Law is always and eternally a question of who gets the decision this time and how much does he get. It's always a matter of adjustment, always a matter of compromising, conflicting claims, always a matter of allocating enough so that you don't kill him, and still try to preserve what you call the better argument. Better, not right, better. More useful, not dysfunctional. This one works more efficiently. This time, for this guy. This kind of a sliding adjustment, it's a system of compromise. It is. It's a system. Well, that's probably unnerving enough to make 50% of the guys drop out of law school. And that's about the average that we lose traditionally in the first year. Most people come to law school in a search for certainty. They soon find out that it's not there, and so they leave the law school and go to seminary or someplace else. And it's also very unnerving. And now let me try to reestablish a little bit, to rebuild a little bit on the damage that I may be doing to you. Law comes to us from, that is, the rule now gets verbalized. It gets formed, shaped in different ways. One of the ways is by legislation, and we talked about that at some length yesterday, and I simply put it down so that you will think of it again. Legislation may be by the city council, maybe by the county board of commissioners, maybe by the state legislature, maybe by the Congress, and it's a good way, and it would be nice if we had enough, small enough group and close enough communication so we could all be part of the rules that were enacted. The chairman of my thesis committee, a wise old man, had lots of corny sayings, and one that he loved more dearly than almost others was, if you leave your law to lawyers, you will soon have for law your law the lawyers leaving. And people, if you leave your law to lawyers, you will soon have for your law the lawyers leaving. Pretty badly picked over. And of course, that's true of leaving probation rules to probation officers, a wonderful way of shaping all the probation rules so that only the probation officer is convenient to serve, and the poor old guy out here is supposed to be rehabilitated gets murdered. It's the same thing with leaving the rules for organization of schools to the school teachers, and you soon have all kinds of rules which help the teacher and not so much the student. It's the thing that's made it necessary in a hospital for the patients who are paying anywhere from $50 to $100 a day to be shaken into consciousness at 4:30 in the morning in order that they can get all the bedpans through in time so they can get ready for it. The whole thing is run for the convenience of the establishment, and it's a God-given gift to help yourself, I guess, rather than the person that you're supposed to be serving. The concept of ministry is not a legal concept. The concept of preserving my own, giving you your fair share and I will take mine, is a legal concept. That's why I call it a poverty program. Now, in this process, you see, of legislation, there's very much of this that goes on. A legislature legislates rules that serve the people who are in the legislature or who are represented, and these become selfish rules. There's no use going to the legislature and saying, let us as a state now commit suicide on behalf of the starving Asians and give all of our goods to them. A legislature can understand an argument which says, if you don't do something for the black community this year, they will rise up in their wrath and burn your cities. Therefore, give them enough to keep the darn heathen quiet. And a legislator can respond to that, see, in legislation. But if you go to the legislature and say, look, fellas, we've got more than we need, let's all empty our pockets, put it on the table, and divide up fairly, they'll look at you and say, you've lost your legal marbles. And I want to say to you just as convincingly as I can, that law cannot work otherwise. Law cannot be selfless. Law cannot be outgoing and generous. You can't construct a rule that says when two people are in an argument, the rule is that both shall act for the other's best convenience. Now you can say, well, I can do it morally, see? Never do to another person what you wouldn't want him to do to you. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's great. And we'll talk about it in just a minute. Another source from which we get our rules, and we're talking here about rules, is the so-called common law. Well, that's not a very good way of putting that. Let's just call it decision law. That is, a case comes to the court, and the court then has to resolve that problem. When it's heard all the arguments, when it's come through the end and it makes a decision, then the judge will say, the law is that, and he will announce it. Now, as I told you yesterday, a judge will never admit to you, at least it's wasn't good form, and it's just gradually becoming so. Normally, we do not like to hear our judges say, I am now making a law. I am legislating. Normally, the judge will say, I am announcing what the rule is. This is not a court in which my will is being done. It's under law. It's regulated by the rules. And I am simply interpreting and applying that rule to you. And usually it is, but not always. Every once in a while, there isn't any rule there. And the judge has to make one up. And then he does it by, no, not really by looking up at the clouds and finding it, but by going through a very carefully regulated system of listening to people, of doing it in a way that makes them feel that they are participants, fairly represented, and then working out a compromise which, on all the available evidence, looks like it's the most useful way of doing it. That's the legal system. And it isn't really true to say that the judge just looks up there and says, this is the rule. Well, these decisions which are reached are then brought down and they are used as precedent for other decisions. And so if I get a case which is analogous to one that went before, I try and say that, well, you decided this case this way before and this case is the same, and therefore you've got to come out the same way on this one. And I try to do this by a predictive basis. So this is the way that I use former precedents as a prediction. Lots of names for this. When a thing has once been decided, some jurisdictions have what is known as a rule. Stare decisis, that is, sticking by former decisions. Once you've decided something, it's at rest. Stare decisis means you leave it there. England, for example, says that the court having once spoken, it can never go back and change its mind because courts, like consuls and like popes, do not err. They are infallible. To err is impossible for a court. This isn't. In the United States, the court is now quite willing to say, we goofed. And the case of Smithers against Smithers from this day on will no longer be authority. We've just changed that. Speak for the Church Council of the American Lutheran Church. It is capable of error. I have been a member for some time, and I have on a number of occasions voted on the minority position, thereby demonstrating that the council erred. Or if that does not happen to be persuasive to you, I suggest reading the minutes on anything over a five-year span, and notice how frequently the Church Council reverses an earlier position, and perhaps that will be more convincing to you. Error, or at least mobility, is entirely possible within the church structure. Now, I have told you about statutes or ordinances which are formulated by legislative bodies or commissions or councils, whatever. And I have told you about decisions which become part of the precedental law because a court which has jurisdiction, that is, it has the authority, it has the right, it has the power to speak, is spoken, and that becomes a precedent from which I argue my case. The other thing which is really different qualitatively is constitution. How do you measure the validity of a law itself? What is the difference between a constitution and a statute? A statute or an ordinance, a decision, speaks to a very precise problem. It mostly is like a rifle shot. Thou shalt not go more than 35 miles an hour is a pretty specific kind of a thing. While constitutional law tends to speak in overarching principles, big concepts, by which you measure the validity of the statements about little concepts. You test the validity of the statute of the enactment by seeing whether or not it's constitutional. When a court starts interpreting a statute, the court asks himself the question of what did the legislating body mean? What did they say? What were they trying to communicate to me in the language of the statute? That's not always an easy exercise because words are very elusive in their meaning at times. But the name of the game is, what did the legislature intend when it enacted this statute? Any of you who have ever been close to a legislating body know that the legislature normally has no intention about anything. When the state of Washington adopted the Uniform Commercial Code, which was a bill about that thick, maybe 700 or 800 pages of print, numbers of us who were wise enough to be experts about this went down to the legislature to testify to the legislative committee. Committee of about a dozen people on the committee, three of whom would be in attendance at any one time, rotating group as they went in and out of the room. And while I was, well, it's like a convention in the American Lutheran Church, one third there to move, one third to discuss, and the other third to vote. The rest of the rest of them being out for coffee or other business. It's the same in the legislative process. You put this bill in, you are ready to discuss it, and so in the process of this, one of the senators asked me a question, and I said, well, Senator, as I've mentioned before, the bill sets that out, and he gave me the tagline, of course, in which he said, you don't think that I've read that. No legislator reads a majority of the bills that go through the House. Obviously, they don't. We have somewhere in the vicinity of 36 to 4,000 bills introduced in the typical legislative session. Thank God, only about 1,000 are enacted. And I'm doubly thankful for the fact that most of those are not important, and you can ignore them. But when you do get hung up on one, you've got to come back and ask the question of what does it mean? And you look for the so-called legislative intent, and you're pretty much bound by the particulars of the thing. You don't have much room to wiggle in a statute or an ordinance because it's pretty much of a rifle thing. But in a constitution, you're looking for big, broad principles, not nearly as precise. It's a much greater thing. Statutes are the way that the legislature, they say what the legislature intended. The constitution is fresh every morning, and you get to interpret it each day all over again. You are not bound to precision in the same way that you are to statutes. I'd like to illustrate this for you by telling you about a statute the state of Washington has, and then asking you to decide a couple cases for me under it. We have a statute that's known as an award in lieu of homestead. A person may claim a homestead exemption to protect property from creditors during the lifetime. If a homestead is not claimed by a man and a woman, a husband and wife, homestead exemption to save this property from their creditors, if this is not claimed during their lifetime, under the statutory law of the state of Washington, it is possible for the surviving spouse, gotta be a surviving spouse, to claim an award in lieu of homestead from the assets of the deceased spouse. But you've got to have a married couple, one dies, no homestead claim during the life. The surviving spouse then may claim an award, it's up to $10,000, award in lieu of the homestead that could have been acquired during life from the assets of the deceased spouse. Now that's perfectly clear, isn't it? All right, now take a case. The first case that came up in the state of Washington was this one. There was a man of some years, he was a widower, he had an 18-year-old son who was an imbecile. The man's wife had died some years before, he had a very small estate, less than $5,000. He was lonely, he wrote to the Lonely Hearts Club, natural thing to do, and in due time a woman appeared from Strawberry Point, Iowa, or someplace like that, and came out to Seattle, King Street Station, got off the train. They had arranged to be married. They were married shortly after noon. The strain was too much for the old boy, and he died of a heart attack about 2:30, 3 o'clock that afternoon, like this. Well, of course, the woman was broken up by this, but as she began to think about it, it occurred to her that she was a surviving spouse, that they had not claimed a homestead during their joint life, and so she petitioned the court for an award in lieu of homestead. The representatives for the 18-year-old boy came to the court and said, look, if you give the woman up to $10,000 out of a $5,000 estate, you're going to deprive this child of all of its assets. Surely the legislature could not have meant to take away from this child who needs the assets so much and will become a burden upon the public charity of the state of Washington, and give the property to a woman who is a widow of 2.5 hours, who hasn't contributed 1 cent. The legislature simply could not have meant that. Counsel for the wife said, read the act. It says, married, no homestead declared during the joint life, a death, an award in lieu of homestead up to $10,000 out of the estate of the deceased. All right, ladies and gentlemen, how do you decide that case? Who wins, husband, the wife, or the boy? Boy? Oh, sentimental oafs you are. Obviously, you got to give it to the widow. The legislature said, and you can't rewrite that law. You've got to do it the way the law says. See? Otherwise, you would be letting your personality get into this decision. You're a judge. You can't call these things as you see them. You're a judge. You do it the way the law says you have to do it. The legislature gets to make the rule. You implement it. Are you got that? All right. Next day, this case came in. A man got into an argument with his wife. He picked up an axe, split her down the middle. She died. He was tried for murder, convicted. He was sent down to Walla Walla. He ran short of cigarettes, and suddenly, the inspiration. I'm a surviving spouse. So he petitioned the court for an award in lieu of homestead, pointing out that he had been married, he survived, they'd claimed no homestead, and he won an award up $10,000 out of the separate assets of his wife. She had money, he didn't. The representatives for the wife came to the court and said, surely the legislature did not intend judging that. What are you talking about? We have already settled that point. The legislature said they did not make any exceptions. They didn't say except imbecile children or except murdering spouses. So, man gets the property. At this point, down to the Supreme Court you go, and you say to the Supreme Court, I think the trial judge erred in his decision. What do you think about that? All right, ladies and gentlemen, does the man get the property or does he not?
He gets it. It's still legal.
He gets it. It's still legal. You got to do what the rule says.
Can't you just get a small token?
Split the difference. Are you uncomfortable? Listen, the one thing that you cannot do in law is to split the difference. Solomon tried it. And the mother said, don't cut the baby, give it to her, see? You can't split the difference. It's right or it's wrong. Don't kid me. It's better or it's worse. The one thing a judge cannot do is to say that case is too tough for me, I can't decide it. That's why they brought it to him. If there were a person in society smart enough to figure out the answer, he wouldn't have to go to the court and ask for a judgment. All right, decide the case. Well, we don't have time to do it the way I'd like to do it. The Supreme Court of the state of Washington said, the man doesn't get the property. The legislature, we know, did not intend that the property would go to the husband who murdered his wife. There is kind of a silent exception written into this thing. It's there. We can see it. We know it. The legislature didn't mean it. Now, you see, you can play 1,000 variations on this theme. I was telling Rosemary last night that there's a very useful word you ought to know about. It's called P-I-L-P-U-L. Pilp. It's a word that comes to us out of the Hebrew. Hebrew rabbis were apparently the original experts in this. It means to take something that says something apparently literally on its face and chew away at it with little gradations and little switches and little modifications and change it, finally have it come out the other way. A development of doctrine, precisely. You see, you start out with the infallibility of the church council and you wind up in the American Lutheran Church. Where you can go the complete distance, you see, and come around the other way and make the literal words serve quite a different meaning. Now, this process of interpretation is an extremely difficult one for the court, and as I've already tried to indicate, the court is always working in the context of a rule which cannot be precise to govern the specific case. You can't write that many rules. There always has to be interpretation. And there isn't any answer, and usually the facts will come in the context of great disputes. One witness comes in, an automobile accident, and you put him on the stand. How fast was the car going? He says 60 miles an hour. You put on the other car, the other man, how fast was the car going? 20 miles an hour. And they both believe they're telling the truth. And there's no way of knowing. And somebody has to decide. And you give that question to what we call the trier of the fact. How do you know how fast the car was really going if there is no other evidence except two people's uncorroborated statements and neither one of them really know, you know? You get a blowout and somebody stops you instantly and says, how fast were you going? You wouldn't be able to answer. You get kind of an impression. But you must know. So we do it scientifically. We choose 12 of you and ask them. You go back in the back room, roll ice or whatever you do, and you come out and you announce the car was going 37 and a half miles an hour. At this point, I must tell you something. That car was going 37 and a half miles an hour. I don't care what you think it was going. And we do this constantly in finding facts. When the fact is announced by the finder of fact, if he is making an honest judgment, that is it. Those are the facts. We see this most frequently in the context of a baseball game. You've got a man back there who's going to pitch, and a guy there is going to try and hit it, and another guy is going to try and catch it. And then we put another guy behind him. and we say to him, you're the fellow who's going to tell the balls from the strikes. And I suppose that you think that the rule book says that any ball that goes within this above the shoulder, down the bottom of the kneecap, the outside of the bases, is a strike, and any one that goes outside is a ball. That is not what the rule book says. The rule book says that a pitched ball, which in the opinion of the umpire passed within that described area, is a strike. Three umpires were talking about this, and one of them said, I call them as I see them. The other one said, I call them as they are. And the third one said, they aren't anything until I call them. You see, this third guy is right. It is neither a strike nor a ball until the guy back here says, ball. And the fact that he happens to have missed it completely, he had dust in his eyes and something like that, he has the power to make this kind of an error. We give him that power and he decides the facts. Now that factual judgment is going to bind us on the facts unless the guy is abusing his discretion. And so on appeal on the facts, what you're trying to say is that the referee abused his discretion, that although he knew that the ball came within that scope, because this team was so far behind and he wanted to see the other guys the opposite, he thought it would be a more interesting ball game if he would say, ball, just to walk in a few runs and even up the score. This is not the jurisdiction we give this man. He is bound by a rule. He must, within his fair judgment inside of that rule, and this becomes very, very important with reference to rules which are announced by legislating bodies or city councils or anybody else. A rule is the outside limits. I can use no better analogy for it than saying it's like a room in my house or any other room like this. If you would take our front room, now it has a certain character. It's given that character by my wife, my children, and I. It's the way we furnish it. It's sort of early American miscellaneous. And we live in it, newspapers all over the place, and stacks of books, and broken hi-fi sets, and all of these things. It has a character. If you moved in after we moved out of that house, and didn't move any walls, would not change any windows, no doors, leave the ceiling and the floor there, but you are Scandinavian modern, you don't let newspapers lie around, children don't have free run, without changing the rule, without changing the rule one bit, you give it a totally different character. And a judge has that much discretion. Now the trick is to keep the judge down to where he doesn't have uncontrolled discretion. And if you start getting decisions coming out of a body inside of this rule, where sometimes it's yes and sometimes it's no, yes, no, yes, no, and you begin to observe after a while that there seems to be some kind of a pattern in the way that these decisions are being handed down to you, what you really know is that you have an overclassification inside of your rule. So you divide it here and you make two rules, one for cars and one for trucks, one for adults and one for minors. Because if you keep getting this diversity of opinion, you've overclassified and the judge doesn't have and people don't have enough predictive basis to be able to let them resolve their disputes in advance. Precision is necessary in order to pull down the arbitrariness of a court, and so you try and define your rules as close to the situation as you can without totally stifling imagination. When it comes to the Constitution, that's something entirely different. Because the Constitution now is not to answer precise problems. It isn't rifling out after the speed of traffic. It's talking about great big problems. And there's lots of room in the Constitution, tremendous flexibility. Finally, when you get to the United States Supreme Court, they interpret the Constitution, maybe not like they did yesterday, but that's all right. They're within the room that they have, the power that they have. Now, we must honestly recognize what is going on. As the court said very recently in one of its opinions, the Supreme Court of the United States is not the last court to which you can go because it's infallible, but it is infallible because it's the last court to which you can go. And that's a very different thing. There's no one beyond the Supreme Court to make a decision. Not unless we want to junk that system and say that every case decided by the court is subject to review, for example, by Congress, in which case, of course, you have radically altered the form of government that we now use. Let me take just about two or three more minutes, and then I'll turn you loose for a cup of coffee. Having brought you this far, I want you to see the rest of this. All that I've said this morning is reflected in what we think about the sources from which law comes to us. Thomas Clance, in so-called national law, said that there are some things which just are. They're just naturally so. That these are immutable principles. Love, hate, at the best, the natural lawyers were people who spoke in terms of immutable processes, systems. At the worst, they were people who tried to tie natural law down to things like, and you can find this in thousands of opinions, literally, that it is well known that you cannot have a contract unless the parties are in mutual agreement. And it's just you can't have anything else. Everybody knows that. It's just naturally true. Now, that's the worst of the natural lawyers. The best, as I say, are people who think of the process, of the processes as being kind of ordained. Natural law is great in terms of value systems, of giving us these overarching principles, the things for which you really fight, you get emotionally involved. Never do to another person what you don't want him to do to you is a pretty good natural law. Well, now let's take that down to a specific illustration, like when a check is forged and it goes through a bank and it goes through an intermediate bank and goes to the ultimate paying bank, and along the line one bank becomes bankrupt and now somebody's going to be out some money, which bank or which person shall bear the loss? Rule of law that you apply is never do to anybody else what you don't want them to do to you. The judge says, the client says, well, does that mean that I get the money, Your Honor, or does he get the money? And the judge says, well, never do to anybody else what you don't want him to do to you. And clients say, well, we're in contest as to whether or not I'm stuck or he's stuck. Which way does it come out? Now, to repeat over and over, the general abstract principle simply doesn't cut any ice. It doesn't resolve the conflicts that come up in the daily routine of life. You've got to get it down below, and you've got to measure what you're going to do with very specific cases. So we have a lot of other people who are essentially positivists, or sometimes called realists. They're the people who say that law is essentially a putting together of sociologically observed phenomena that are useful to us at a given time, and there aren't any absolutes, any naturals, any God-given principles from which we must depart. Best known in this field is a man by the name of Hans Kelsen, who wrote a book called The Pure Science of Law. And Kelsen said that you simply depart from something like the will of the nation ought to be observed, and then scientifically, deductively, you take from that principle things which will undergird that overall accomplishment, desired goal of the people, and you serve it. Hans Kelsen was a man who first became popular in about 1920 in Vienna. He is a Jewish scholar and a very good one. I had the privilege of studying under him for a while when I was doing some graduate work. I guess I will never forget Hans Kelsen coming to me on one occasion and sort of grabbing my coat lapels and saying, Ricky, do you think I am responsible for the death of the Jews under Hitler? And the answer to that is yes, doctor. In a very large way you are, because Nuremberg and all that it represents is a nation which says that we think that the advancement of this country will best be served by rules which develop us as a strong people, make us more efficient, etc. And there aren't any overarching principles that say that it's wrong to kill people. You do what will serve the need of the people. And this is our judgment about it. And so, in a positive sense, in a pure science of law sense, Germany used Hans Kelsen, you see. And you can't have a system which does not answer the questions, nor can you work a system which permits this kind of intolerable consequence to come out of your legal system. So what do you do with it? Well, you come down to sort of the great muddle head, the great American proposition, the great middle, call it whatever you like. Call it, we believe that we are endowed with certain inalienable rights by our Creator, which is either a very profound or a totally idiotic statement. I'm not quite sure which we write into our basic documents, and we sort of say to each other that you have a right as a human being. That is, you have certain inalienable rights which are simply given to you by God, which the government cannot take from you. And among these are things like, and then we start listing, you see. Our Constitution protects you in your life, in your liberty, in your property. It may not be taken from you. No one can take your life away from you by capital punishment. No one may deprive you of liberty, like putting you in jail. No one may take your property away from you, like fining you for speeding too fast. It's unconstitutional. Those are God-given rights, inalienable. Neither your life, nor your liberty, nor your property may be taken away from you. Oh, except by due process of law, of course. Except by due process of law. And what is due process? Frankfurter said, not recently, that when a man is entitled to a type of process, when there is a certain kind of process which is his due, and he doesn't get it, he has been deprived of due process. Can you do any better with him? You see, here you have then an evolutionary growth of a system which says that we have certain perceptions about the way that we ought to deal with each other. We are willing to formalize certain general principles under which we operate. And we are willing to bind our court inside of little boxes or constitutionally inside of big boxes. That we are willing to sort of subscribe to the idea that there are some things which ought not to be disturbed, and they are good. At least they're so much better that they almost become good. You know, they almost become absolute. At the same time, we recognize that we've got to test by measure of utility our individual rules. Kelsen is absolutely great on testing the utility of law. He is as great in utility testing as Aquinas was in value guarding. Either one of them alone is inadequate. This is the story of Christianity. Christianity is law and gospel. Christianity recognizes two systems by which people may relate to each other, a system of law and a system of grace. And it does not force you to that impossible compromise that we've been talking about this morning of saying it's either law or it's grace. Because the whole punchline of the New Testament is the redeemed person living in love lives beyond the poverty level of the law with those persons with whom he may relate in love. Mutual respect and integrity, insofar as it is possible with you. Where it is not possible with you, then you have the utility of the legal system, a very great gift of God. It's an other way of relating to people with whom you must relate, because you cannot ignore the rest of the world. It's there. And if you go out of the city and build your habitation in the wilderness, you're kidding yourself. If you say that we can live without structure, without establishment, that's not true. The whole difficulty with the modern movements is that they are totally sterile and unproductive. You've got to have a rich father to be a hippie. You can't live without society. You must relate to society. If society will not accept the rather rich, the much richer form of life which we know as grace, then we must relate to them in law. And it gives us a way of preserving some fragments of relationship to each other. It avoids total alienation. It avoids violence to some degree. Not totally, of course, because law in itself, the use of rules, is always injurious. It is always poverty. It always demands. It is always selfish, and it cannot work otherwise for reasons which I have clearly explained, and I'm sure that you thoroughly understand. On the other hand, it does not mean that one cannot be gracious, that one cannot be charitable. You may. It's just that you don't have to. There is no compulsion in Christianity. Christianity knows no compulsion. As Justice Black said in the opinion that I wrote to you two nights ago, it would be absurd as a matter of law to punish a man for something he cannot control. And it would be absurd as a matter of law. But as a matter of grace, to recognize differences of status, you are or you are not, is not absurd. It is simply a recognition of what is. And in exactly the same context, you must think of Christianity as never being a legal function, nor does God ever punish. It is simply a recognition of alienation. That's hell. Over here on this side, you have coercion and the processes of the law. And coercion and sanctions and how that works is something that I can talk to you about tomorrow. And you're overdue for a cup of coffee. Go away.